Good evening and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor of the Cure Panel, joining you from India, and I welcome all of you for a discussion on prostate cancer. All Cure Panel shows on prostate cancer are conducted in association with Prostate Cancer International and Prostate Cancer Foundation. This is the sixth time we are discussing prostate cancer on the Cure Panel platform. On our previous episode, we discussed active surveillance for management of low-risk prostate cancer with Dr. Lawrence Claus of Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center, Toronto. Today we have with us a very distinguished guest, Dr. Ian Thompson. Dr. Thompson is Professor Glenda and Gary Wood's Distinguished Chair in Geo-Oncology at the University of Texas Health Science Center, San Antonio. He currently serves as Vice Chair of the Early Detection Research Network of the National Cancer Institute and is Chair of the Genitourinary Committee of the Southwest Oncology Group, the largest clinical trials organization supported by the National Cancer Institute. Welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show, Dr. Thompson. My co-host for the show is Michael E. Scott. Mike is co-founder and president of Prostate Cancer International, a prostate cancer-specific, not-for-profit educational and informational organization based in Virginia. Mike is executive vice president of Independence HealthCom Strategies Group, a privately held group of healthcare communications companies based in Philadelphia. He is also a member of the board of directors of the National Organization for Rare Diseases and the International Myeloma Foundation. Supporting Dr. Thompson and Mike on the panel are experienced and knowledgeable prostate cancer survivors and advocates, Thomas Kirk, Jan Manorite, and Paul Carpenter. I extend a hearty welcome to all panelists and to all our listeners. Today we are discussing clinical trials in prostate cancer. Clinical drug trials play a crucial role in moving new treatments to patients who need them most, securing data so regulatory approvals can be obtained and new drugs can move into widespread clinical practice. Patients who participate in clinical trials provide an invaluable service both to treatment science and fellow patients. There are currently more than several phase 3 drug trials and more than 90 phase 1 and 2 trials in process for prostate cancer in North America and Europe. Over the coming 1 hour, we are going to learn more about ongoing clinical trials in prostate cancer. I would like to remind all our listeners that we will be discussing questions sent in via email at the end of the show. You can mail your questions to priya@trialx.com. And if you want to ask a question live, please press 1 on your keypads and we will bring you on air to ask them. With that, I will now hand over to Mike to begin with the discussion. Mike, you're live on air. Dr. Thompson, welcome to the show. I think Mike is running a bit late and he will be joining us. Can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Oh, thank you. Yes, yes, loud and clear. Thank you very much, Dr. Thompson. I think Mike is a bit late. I apologize for him. I think we can just go ahead and begin with the show when, until Mike joins us. Dr. Thompson, I'll just go over Mike's questions that he was planning to ask you. What do you think has been the most important new data that were presented at the annual meetings of the AUA and ASCO this year? And can you please talk a little bit and give us a quick summary of how you think any of this data will be practice changing?
So I think the most appropriate, I'm going to reword your question and say, what are the most important new data that have either been published or presented in the last 6 or 8 months or so, some of which were at AUA, some of which were ASCO, and some of which were GU ASCO. And I think probably one that certainly gets our attention was the results of the CHARTED trial, which were presented, that took patients with advanced prostate cancer, randomizing them to androgen deprivation therapy versus androgen deprivation therapy and docetaxel immediately, and there was a significant improvement in survival. And that was presented at ASCO, had a substantial amount of an impact. And to me, that is one of these practice-changing concepts that moving, in fact, I just got off a conference call where we were discussing another clinical trial that was another clinical trial and discussing how an agent like docetaxel could have an impact of a few months in patients with advanced castrate-resistant disease, whereas it had perhaps a fourfold, fivefold greater impact in patients with hormone-naive disease. And the evidence is accumulating that for advanced and for high-risk prostate cancer, earlier may be better for agents that that have an impact on the disease. And that may be earlier, may be better for androgen deprivation therapy, as we've seen through the T3 studies in association with radiotherapy. And now we're seeing this with cytotoxics. And obviously the next question will be that I think needs to be addressed, and it's being addressed currently by an ongoing trial conducted by SWOG, and it's on the CTSU menu, is a randomized trial of androgen deprivation therapy of an LHRH agonist with an anti-androgen bicalutamide versus an LHRH agonist plus the Takeda, the TAC 700 agent, to compare those two agents. So I think earlier for the high-risk patients with prostate cancer is going to be very important, that we've seen through CHARTED. So that's one of the really key observations that has been made recently. Another observation that I think we're increasingly seeing, and it surprised me at the AUA meeting that Dr. Laurie Klotz from University of Toronto and Dr. Mark Emberton from the UK and I were teaching a postgraduate course on active surveillance, and it ended up being scheduled at 6 a.m. on a Sunday morning. And I told Mark and Laurie, I said, I don't think anybody's going to show up. I certainly wouldn't get up at 6 o'clock to come to that course. And the room was packed. And the observations that were made in that meeting were the continued durability of disease-specific survival in patients who were appropriately selected and placed on active surveillance. The patients have disease-specific survivals of 97-98%, and it's really remarkable that it's durable over time. So I think that perhaps the most interesting clinical trial observations that we've seen recently have been perhaps at the bookends of the disease, one being for advanced disease, the earlier use of docetaxel in metastatic hormone-naive prostate cancer, and perhaps the greater degree of interest in active surveillance.
Thank you, Doctor.
If I could just kind of continue that. If I kind of continue that concept, there's, you know, just recently were published a longer-term follow-up of the Scandinavian trial in patients with, if you will, somewhere in the middle. And these were patients that were diagnosed generally not by PSA, but were diagnosed by digital rectal examination, perhaps 15, 20 years ago, and in the pre-PSA era, and these patients actually had quite high PSAs. So this would be considered to be, if you will, intermediate to higher risk prostate cancers that were randomized to radical prostatectomy versus watchful waiting. And understand that this was not an active surveillance randomization, but this was watchful waiting. And the continued follow-up of that study showing the continued benefit of intervention for those patients. I think that's a very critical observation. Now, what's happened in the lay media is that they have taken that study to justify treatment for all prostate cancers, lowest grade, lowest volume, and so forth. And clearly, that's not going to be the case. That doesn't translate to that. And the final recent update was has been the continued interest in the screening studies that suggest that screening has an impact on the disease and a reduction in mortality. So all these things all fit together, suggesting perhaps less intense therapies for low-risk patients and continued justification for perhaps monotherapy or combination therapy in intermediate-risk patients, earlier therapies in patients with advanced disease.
Thank you, Doctor. What are some of the most important new trial data that you're actually watching out for in the next 12 or 18 months? And which of these trials you think might be practice-changing for physicians and patients?
Well, there are several of these that are ongoing, and if it were one of our own studies in the Southwest Oncology Group, I wouldn't be able to tell you because the Data and Safety Monitoring Committee are monitoring those and would tell us when they're mature. And in the other groups, the same sort of thing. But there are some trials that are maturing that it may not be 12 to 18 months, but we'll be seeing in the near future. One trial is continuing to accrue, and it's near its accrual goal, but it's a very important study, and it's a randomization. It's the CALGB 90203 study, which Jim Eastham is the principal investigator of that, and it's a neoadjuvant docetaxel and androgen deprivation therapy before prostatectomy in high-risk patients. And I think this is a profoundly important study because what it's doing is it's looking at patients who are at the highest risk at the time of radical prostatectomy based on some risk criteria, based on PSA and Gleason score and volume and stage and so forth, and treating these patients up front with combination of chemotherapy and androgen deprivation therapy. This is going to be an important study. And we'll see when it will be mature. Now, one concern that I have about that study in terms of its power and when we'll be able to see the results are the results that were published of the SWOG study, 9921, which was a randomized study of patients who are also high risk, post-prostatectomy to mitoxantrone hormone therapy for 2 years versus hormone therapy for 2 years alone. And that's a study that what we have done is to publish the initial results of the, if you will, control arm. And these are patients, again, node positive, high-risk patients post-prostatectomy in whom standard of care is nothing other than perhaps postoperative radiotherapy. And the patients were randomized to, we felt that in the design of this trial that a suitable control arm would be 2 years of androgen deprivation. And in the experimental arm, at that point in time, this is before docetaxel was available, the patients were randomized to mitoxantrone and hormone therapy. And the important take-home message from this study, which is a really intriguing one, is the very high rates of disease-specific survival and even biochemical relapse-free survival in the patients who had had a radical prostatectomy and had 2 years of hormone therapy only. Their testosterone levels came back in the majority of these patients, and nonetheless, their rates of recurrence, which we had estimated at 5 years to be 40%, were only about in the 8% range. And so what it tells me, and I think it would tell the kind of impassioned or the objective observer who's looking at those data, is it tells us two things. Number one of two things. One is that our ability to define high-risk patients in non-metastatic disease is going to be increasingly difficult. And there have been several papers in this patient population of treatments that have very high survival rates. So this is, again, high-risk patients who have radical prostatectomy and concurrent adjuvant therapies. Very high rates of survival and disease-specific survival in these patients, which calls into question our ability to define high-risk disease. The other thing that may be a possible conclusion for this is that in these patients that we would anticipate a really remarkable disease-free survival and long-term disease-specific survival with combination therapies. So we'll see. Whether 90203 will report early or not is a question I don't know the answer to, but it's going to be very, very helpful to us. And of course, the clear question is who are going to be the patients that need the therapy and will benefit? I saw a patient just in the last few weeks who had a Gleason 5+5 prostate cancer. He was pathologic T3 after his radical prostatectomy, and he's now 12 years out with an undetectable PSA, receiving only 2 years of androgen deprivation therapy. Now, that's an anecdote, but that man was on that clinical trial, and 12 years out with a Gleason 10 really speaks to the opportunity of combination therapies administered to high-risk patients being potentially beneficial. And the last study that we're going to be looking out for in the next 12 to 18 months will be there will probably never be a final analysis, but an analysis of the prostate cancer prevention trial that is going to be looking at prostate cancer-specific survival, or disease-specific survival. Now, this past August, we published the overall survival of the two arms of the study, showing that the overall survival was the same, and showed as well that the overall survival of patients with prostate cancer in the two arms by grade was identical. And what my colleagues are doing in Seattle is doing evaluations. We now have cause-specific mortality and going to be looking at that to determine what the prostate cancer-specific mortality will be. No idea what it'll be, but it'll be very interesting to be able to address the question about what is the risk of a prostate cancer death in the two arms of the study now that we know that the survival is the same and now that we know that the relative risk reduction is in about the 30% range. So a profound impact on prostate cancer risk, and the question is, what's the impact on the risk of dying from prostate cancer?
Thank you, Doctor. At this point, I'd like to just bring on the panelists and introduce them to you. We have with us Thomas Kerr. Thomas is President and CEO of US2 International, the Prostate Cancer Education and Support Network. Since joining US2 as a President and CEO in November 2004, Tom has been active in the prostate cancer community by building collaborations, expanding visibility for prostate cancer issues, and expanding and improving services, adding to his experience as a family service leader addressing cutting-edge issues. Tom, you are on air. Please ask your question. Tom, can you hear me? Tom, can you hear me, please? Next on the panel, we have Dan on the right. Dan is a senior education research data of the PCRI, Prostate Cancer Research Institute. At PCRI, Dan leads the helpline staff, develops advocacy projects, speaks publicly, and writes in edits for the publications. On the panel, we also have Paul Carpenter. Paul is a patient advocate for men diagnosed with prostate cancer. He has contributed to dozens of online groups and forums and also co-founded a Los Angeles support group for gay and bisexual men living with prostate cancer. I apologize to all the listeners. I think our Blog Talk Radio is having some issues with people trying to call in, and hence the audio difficulties that we're facing right now. Tom, can you hear me now? I'm afraid Tom is not able to hear. Jan, are you on?
Here.
Jan, can you hear me? Yes. Jan, can
you
hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great, great, Jan. Can you please ask your questions to Dr. Thompson, please?
Sure, and thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. I was listening closely to a lot of what Dr. Thompson was saying, and I did catch some of the studies at AUA and ASCO this year, but to be fair, I didn't spend a lot of time. I had some other projects I was doing, but I guess my first question would be, in the listening audience, how many of them are patients and how many are medical professionals, the people that are listening to us today? Do we know, Priya?
Yes, please.
Because I'm just have a few terms that I think might be helpful to the listening audience to clear up if they're patients, because I think there's sometimes a lot of confusion. So would it be okay if I asked a couple of questions about that?
This is Ian. Go ahead. Sure, of course.
Hi. Thanks. Yeah. I think, first of all, sometimes patients get confused as to hormone therapy versus androgen deprivation therapy, and we have multiple terms for the same phrase, so sometimes that can be a little confusing that it's the same thing. So I think that might be helpful.
Yeah, so that's a good point. We sometimes use the medical vernacular, which oftentimes leaves folks behind, so that's a very good point. So when we talk about androgen deprivation.
Yeah, and I'm having just a little bit of interference. I don't know if other people are, so
yes. Someone's reading on the phone. So if you're not talking, I'll mute mine. Everybody else will mute theirs while listening.
Okay.
So the androgen deprivation therapy and hormone therapy, we oftentimes use interchangeably. In general, they're really quite similar. And I would just say that hormone therapy, androgen deprivation therapy, for a patient standpoint, is fundamentally about the same.
Yeah, and in simple terms, it would be the hormone therapy injections that men receive.
Yes, and so there's hormone therapy. There are variants of it, so that there are some that you can take as a pill, but in general, we're talking about an injection.
Okay. The other one that struck me was a simple, quick explanation of active surveillance versus watchful waiting.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Now, to be able to understand the concept of having a cancer and not actively treating it, it's important to understand that many prostate cancers will be present in men throughout their entire lives and will never be detected. And in fact, before PSA and before our ability to do prostate biopsies in a more efficient way, prostate cancer was actually an unusual tumor. We knew that it was common in men as they aged simply because from studies of men who passed away of other causes, when the prostates were removed, prostate cancers were very common. And so, in fact, you can pretty much take about your age and put a percent behind it, and that's the risk that cancer may be present in the prostate. So when we think about some tumors in which we may not, patients may decide not to treat them, it's oftentimes these very small, slow-growing tumors in which the risk of those tumors growing over time is quite low. The risk of the treatment in terms of urinary, sexual, and bowel complications can be quite high. And so a patient looking at the risks and benefits of the two may prefer a program of simply watching it or keeping surveillance over the tumor, monitoring it carefully, and only intervening at a later point in time if there's evidence that the tumor is growing and may pose risk. And that process is called active surveillance. So that you, if you will, you stretch a net out below the patient, and that net may include PSA tests, physical examinations, and periodic repeat biopsies of the prostate to make sure that you're not missing something, and then only intervene. And in general, even in the most aggressive management strategies, perhaps 20 to 40% of people may ultimately may be treated, which then enables 60 to 80% of people to avoid treatment. So that's active surveillance. Now, a different approach is something called watchful waiting, in which you simply look at the tumor and you say, I think this particular tumor has a very low risk over the man's life expectancy of causing problems, and you just say, we won't do anything. Understanding that if symptoms develop at a later point in time, you might then start hormone therapy or androgen deprivation therapy. That's a different kind of a circumstance, because that might even be a man who has a more advanced tumor that you might expect it might cause problems, say, 10 years later or 5 years later, and the man may have other medical issues that would lead it to be unlikely that the man may live that period of time, in which case you'd say, no reason to do the biopsies, we'll just simply monitor you, and only if you develop symptoms, then do something about it. And that's a watchful waiting approach. So in the man with the low-risk tumor who may be younger, say 65, who has a long life expectancy, you would not do that watchful waiting, like wait until something happens. You would be conducting active surveillance, monitoring it carefully, stretching the net out below the patient, and prepare to treat if and only if there's evidence of a cancer progressing. Long explanation, but it requires an understanding of the biology of the cancer, that there are many common ones that will never cause a problem. You can pretty much select those pretty well to begin with, and there may be others that are bigger tumors, but in which they may not be likely to cause problems, say, in a 10-year or 15-year window, in which case watchful waiting may be more appropriate.
Can I attempt to put my little layman's terminology spin on that?
Yeah.
Maybe would it be fair to say that watchful waiting is sort of, it's not outdated. It was used in previous studies, whereas active surveillance is more contemporary. And maybe the key difference is the difference between watchful and active, and active surveillance, just in the term itself, is more suggestive of watching more closely. In fact, the centers in the United States and Lawrence Klotz, I believe, in Canada, the active surveillance centers, most of them are working on multiparametric MRI and some high-level imaging as part of the program.
Yes. Well, kind of yes and no. And I think that perhaps a better way to say it is that there's a spectrum between active surveillance and watchful waiting. And so, for example, a younger man, you may be seeing that man more frequently, performing biopsies more frequently, and you may be much more carefully attuned to the risk of the cancer growing. That man who is on active surveillance, because I have lots of them, who then get older and they develop other medical issues. Say, for example, I have a gentleman who came in who's now on home oxygen. So they're getting older. At that point in time, the degree of intensiveness of your monitoring is the benefit of treatment at that point in time becomes so much less, and the potential risk of treatment at that point in time becomes so much greater that you really don't need to monitor it with the same degree of frequency. So
Right. It's
a spectrum. So, for example, a man who comes in who's 84 years of age, who's had 3 heart attacks, and somebody biopsied his prostate and found a microscopic Gleason 3+3, the lowest grade, smallest tumor, that man, you can put him on a surveillance protocol, but that man's risk of ever having any problems from his cancer in his lifetime is extremely low. And just driving to the appointments and, God forbid, doing a biopsy and causing the man to have an infection that puts him in an ICU at the age of 84 with 2 heart attacks would be distinctly disadvantageous to him. So what it is, it's the integration of an understanding of the cancer risk with an understanding of the patient's medical conditions, life expectancies, and priorities then determines how you structure what you're going to do after a cancer diagnosis.
Thank you.
Yes, very, very, very good questions. And maybe let me just address the MRI issue as well, because there were some more questions that were going to come up later on. And in, because I have some fixed opinions, so I'm just going to just voice them. And I think Lori would, Dr. Klotz would probably say pretty much the same thing. There's been a tremendous amount of interest in MRI. And when folks use the term multiparametric MRI, fundamentally every MRI done is multiparametric. The trick is to do MRIs that are designed in such or are set up in such a fashion that provide very good images of the prostate and different kinds of methodologies to improve the detection of cancer. And there are some circumstances, and these are what was going to be one of my answers to one of the later questions, is what are some of the promising and current studies being ongoing or studies that are looking at MR. And MR is indeed a very promising modality to help detect cancer and perhaps follow cancer and stage cancer and determine what you're dealing with to begin with, because biopsy, we have to admit, is a fairly random process where the needles are put into the prostate. But there are challenges with MR at the present time. One is that there's a term I'm going to use, the specificity of MRI for detection of prostate cancer is about 70%. Specificity means that if you take 100 people that are normal, that don't have cancer, and you do an MRI in those men, 30% of those MRIs will suggest the presence of an abnormality. And that becomes a bit of a challenge when you're dealing with patients, for example, like I mentioned earlier, the man with a very low-grade, low-volume prostate cancer, in which you are doing MRIs in patients in whom we know without an MRI has a very low likelihood, if you put him on an active surveillance protocol, very low likelihood of having problems from his cancer, other than perhaps finding a tumor over time that needs to be treated. The problem with doing MRs under those circumstances is you're applying a test to a group of patients that have a very low risk, and the test has a 30% false positive rate. That's a problem.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yeah, of course.
But the sensitivity, however, would be higher. And is that correct?
Well, it depends on the individual study, but sensitivity
right.
can run. And to be very honest with you, a lot of the studies that have been done in the clinical trial design era, there are some opportunities to improve the design of MRI clinical trials. It's actually very difficult to design MRI clinical trials. So the sensitivity may be in the 70 to 90%, depending upon what you're doing. And just for the listener, sensitivity means if you have 100 people with cancer, how often is the MRI show cancer? And it's about 70 to 90% of the time. But I think perhaps one way to look at it, and I think a lot of us who are in the business of biomarkers and in active surveillance, where MRI is really perhaps the most useful is in the patient who is on active surveillance or the patient in whom you suspect the presence of prostate cancer and you've done a biopsy and there's no cancer, or the patient who's on active surveillance for prostate cancer and the other findings are inconsistent with your biopsy. So say, for example, you have a PSA that's rocketing up, you find a very low-grade prostate cancer, maybe African-American with family history, and you're very concerned, and for example, you might feel something in the prostate, something that's inconsistent with your biopsy findings, then an MRI can be very useful to identify lesions that may have been missed on biopsy. That's a time where MRIs can be very useful. But one of the challenges of applying MRIs, and it sounds pejorative to use the term willy-nilly, but one of my personal observations is that MRIs are becoming almost ubiquitous in some practices for patients that are at risk of prostate cancer or on active surveillance, is the risk of the false positive test. And that risk of a false positive test is quite high. And then when you chase down those MRIs, you could be doing unnecessary biopsies, especially in very low-risk patients. So it's the ideal circumstance, clinical circumstance, for the application of the MRI. I think most of us are still uncertain as to where it's best going to be used, where we can tell the patient for sure, this test, because we don't want to do the MRI to find prostate cancer. Right? A lot of people say, we've done that, we've found more prostate cancers. Very clearly, that's the wrong endpoint, because we know that in these patients, maybe 60 to 70% of them have prostate cancer. And finding more low-volume, low-grade prostate cancers is not going to benefit the patients. We want to know that the MRI application will actually translate into fewer lives lost from prostate cancer and, concurrently, improved quality of life of the patients. Long answer, sorry.
No, that's okay. I understand. I definitely have more questions, but I don't want to take up Paul or Tom's time. So.
And Dr. Thompson, this is Paul Carpenter. I appreciate your bringing in the other factor of quality of life. So many physicians focus only on length of life. Both are important, of course.
You bet. Completely agree.
I had several questions. Bringing things back to the world of clinical trials, it's something of a marketplace with its own sources of supply and demand. I'm wondering, what suggestions do you have for patients trying to distinguish good trials from bad ones? And once a patient is involved in a trial, how can he best provide meaningful consumer feedback on good and bad experiences within the trial?
That's a brilliant question, an absolutely brilliant question, because it's not unique to prostate cancer. It's going to be true for other studies in other organ sites as well.
Yes, indeed.
So there are a lot of Me Too studies, and when I say Me Too studies, they could be, for example, an agent that... for example, you know, in the business of lowering cholesterol, there are a lot of Me Too cholesterol-lowering agents that we see on a regular basis that may end up being non-generic and are approved and may have a little bit of benefit or pretty much determined to be about the same. So now those studies, however, are very important for having participation to make sure that there are incremental improvements in the medications that are being used for prostate cancer. So those are okay. Those are oftentimes industry trials. So a new agent is being developed and the industry is looking to get an agent into a what we call a therapeutic space, an indication for the agent for the treatment of something for which there's already an agent. So those are those may be attractive to some patients because participation may enable more competition in the space. Oftentimes, they don't help, however, advance the treatment of the disease. And for an individual person who's participating, if I were going to participate in a trial, when I talk to a patient about participation in a trial, I'd like to be able to tell them two things. Number one, well, three things. Number one is that their care will be at least as good. Ideally, I'd like to be able to tell them that in their participation, they may have the opportunity, as that patient who had that Gleason 5 plus 5, to participate in a trial that may improve their own outcomes. And the third thing is that when people participate in clinical trials, many of my patients participate in them, and God bless them, they're my heroes, participate in clinical trials because they say, I want it to be better for my son, my grandson, my next-door neighbor, the person down the street.
Exactly. So actually, I have a follow-up question on that very topic, but please go on.
So the question, one simple way, and I'm sorry to interrupt, and it's a long answer, one way to be able to weed it out is to look to see who's sponsoring it. And if it's sponsored by an organization like the American Cancer Society or the National Cancer Institute, it means that it's gone through a very stringent merit review, and it has the potential to make a huge difference. So that's one way to do it.
And the second half of my question was, how can a patient who's involved in a trial or has completed a trial provide meaningful feedback on how good or bad the experience was?
That's an outstanding question as well. Well, one way to do so is that many studies have what are called quality of life components to them. So they're in, and you'd recognize it as a questionnaire. And so when there are the opportunities as part of the study to provide input as to quality of life issues, please complete those. In large-scale clinical trials, the completion rate of those is perhaps around 70% to 80%. Mm-hmm. And so if that could be taken up to higher numbers, huge impact. The other thing to do is to volunteer that information to the physician or the research associate that is you're interacting with and say, I'd like you to write down this information in my record. Because those are the source documents that then go forward to the sponsor. And the sponsor could be a drug company, could be the National Cancer Institute. You can say, I want you to write down the fact that I had this side effect, or I was dissatisfied with this, or that, by the way, in the prostate business, it could very well be that you had a beneficial side effect, like improvement in urination or something like that. And that piece of information in that source document may provide a clue for future studies that are very important.
Okay, good point. I myself had a rather poor experience with the clinical trial in that I was just left hanging, never learned when it was over, never learned what was expected of me. Finally, I went to clinicaltrials.gov and learned that it had been stopped for lack of participation. No one ever told me, and I wish there were some.
May I ask you what study it was?
I'd be happy to communicate that to you offline.
Oh, okay, that's fine. Yeah.
Sure.
And so that's because there are studies, you know, when clinicaltrials.gov, there are some NCI trials that close because of lack of participation. And it happens, and in general, it's our responsibility once those studies close to inform the participants. And so we try to do that, but it's a responsibility, and that follow-up is very important.
And the reason I'm hesitant to say something on the air was that I was quite disappointed with the way the trial was conducted by this particular physician. So for all I know, it was just an abnormal thing for me. I wouldn't want to blacken his reputation. So,
I see. Yes. But it is important that we try very hard to provide that information back to the participants. But, you know, one thing that the participants, you have earned, and we are privileged and responsible to do this for you, is that if you have a question, make a phone call, and if there's dissatisfaction, that should be communicated and it should be fixed, because it is a remarkable contribution of a participant in a clinical trial to do so. We have we pledge our responsibility to every single one of those folks that are participating.
I'm glad to hear your level of integrity and commitment, and I think that's admirable. That's the spirit I went into it with, and I hope the next one will be more positive than the first one.
Well, thank you, sir.
I did have a follow-up question. I hope I'm not stepping on anyone else's time. Patients sometimes enroll in trials or decline to enroll in trials for reasons that are very different from the pure pursuit of scientific truth. Like you mentioned yourself, a chance for low-cost or no-cost access to certain types of therapy. A more subtle one might be when a patient believes, perhaps correctly for him, that certain side effects would or wouldn't be tolerable for him. I'm thinking of things like continuous ADT versus intermittent ADT and effect on sexual function, very important to some groups of men, less important others. My question is, does such self-selection bias tend to make trial results seem more efficacious than turns out in the real world? And if so, how can such bias be reduced?
Your questions are fabulous.
Well, thank you.
Because you're asking some really fundamental questions. If your point is well taken, that the eligibility, so it's not just the patient self-selection, but it's the eligibility criteria themselves can do this.
Exactly.
So, for example, many studies require that people be healthy. Or not to have normal kidney function or normal liver function, and then we find out that the drug works remarkably well in a healthy population, and then when you take the medication out to the general population, which includes people whose kidney function may not be as good and liver function and so forth, it may not work as well. So what you're bringing up is that people who participate in clinical trials are different than those who don't. And that participation is multifactorial. First off, is that to be able to participate in a clinical trial, you have to be able to read. In general, you have to be able to get to your appointments. You have to have a physician who has the resources and infrastructure to offer a clinical trial. You have to be able to understand the pros and the cons, and sometimes the consent forms these days, as you know, are maybe 20 pages long.
Mm-hmm.
All of these are huge barriers that often makes it more difficult for populations that may have lower reading levels, lower socioeconomic, may require additional visits. They physically may not be able to get to their appointment. They may have a job that they may not be able to miss for one of those interim visits. And so when you look at the, in fact, we just recently published a paper on this, looking at participation in what are called phase 3 and large phase 2 clinical trials, the really big pivotal studies that are published in the high-impact journals. We asked ourselves a question, what fraction of the participants were Hispanic? You know, this is a population that's 17% of the United States. It's going to be very quickly about a quarter of the U.S. population. Turned out that in about half the studies, they didn't report how many Hispanics were in. They reported African Americans, didn't report Hispanics. And in those that reported, it was generally in the 3-4% range, which fundamentally means that we don't know how to treat cancer in Hispanics. Or if there are differences in Hispanics, we don't know what they are. And so we know that what you're saying is exactly correct, that it may not parallel the general population. And what it does is it puts the onus on us as the clinical trialists to do everything possible to make sure that as many of those barriers are broken down. But there are always going to be biases that are in place that may make the results of the clinical trials less generalizable than we would like them to be.
Okay, I think I understand that basically there will be number crunchers on your end doing what they can to adjust from what they know about the demographics of those who signed up to generalize to the larger population, just as sometimes election projecting is done. Yeah. But if you don't ask for the information, don't gather it up front, then those number crunchers have nothing to work with.
Yeah, it's one of those. The only way to actually solve the problem, is to ensure that every single person with a given tumor or a given disease is enrolled prospectively on a clinical trial. It's the only way to answer that question, and that is unethical.
Right.
That will not happen. Concurrently, there are a bunch of other factors that are happening right now. For example, the significant increase in cost of executing these very high quality studies, for example, like the National Cancer Institute studies, for which the reimbursement really has not changed in two decades. And the expense of running those trials has gone up dramatically. It's a real fundamental question that I think we face right now in the United States is our investment in R&D with regards to human health. And proportionately, there is a huge fall in that investment in human health research. And it's a real question about our allocation of resources at a federal level to address these issues that are specifically in prostate cancer.
That could be a whole new topic for us to discuss in another hour. I thank you for raising it.
Yes.
I'd just like to say, maybe Mike is with us, but somehow I think Block Talk Radio is not allowing him to dial in and join us. Mike, if you can hear us, please respond. I guess Mike is really having some problems, and I think some of the listeners, dial-in listeners also may have faced this issue of not being able to reach us. We will definitely look into this. Dr. Thompson, we have received some questions from our listeners via email. I'll just quickly go over them before we wrap up for today. The first question is about an article on Flatiron Health in Monday's Wall Street Journal. He says they are compiling a cloud-based oncology database that provides anonymized patient data regarding outcomes that could augment clinical trial data. What do the experts think will be the impact of such a tool?
Well, I'm not sure what that Wall Street Journal article was talking about, but perhaps if I could maybe generalize the point that was being made when you're talking about analyte data, is that in clinical trials these days, and in fact it's one of the conference calls that we had this week, was on the design of what we call the translational or the correlative studies. So let's say that you have a new drug that you're going to use for advanced prostate cancer, and you hypothesize that that drug is going to be more beneficial than the current standard of care. I mean, a good example might be the phase 3 trial, and I think it's the Alliance trial, of enzalutamide versus enzalutamide, abiraterone, and prednisone. So it's a combination study of patients who have advanced prostate cancer who are being randomized to one drug versus two drugs. And the primary hypothesis of the study is oftentimes, will the combination be better than one, and that the primary outcome that you're measuring is survival. So you want to know whether the two drugs improve the survival. And so what we're currently in the process of doing is when we run these large studies, and this study, I don't know how large it is, but probably in the 400 to 500 to 600 patient range, what you'd like to be able to do is two things. Number one, is that if indeed the combination therapies are superior, you'd like to be able to know who are the patients that are most likely to benefit. And there are some hypotheses that you can test, for example, a genetic signature that might identify the person in whom two drugs is significantly better, so that when you run your study, you collect the samples to begin with, and you may collect samples over time, biologic samples over time, so that when you finally analyze it, you say, perhaps the two drugs are better, but this is the subgroup that benefits. So that in the future, that the take-home message is that not just use two drugs in everybody, but use two drugs in patients that have this signature. But the second thing that we're doing through some of these collections concurrently, and it can involve tissue from biopsies and blood or urine or other samples or even imaging studies, is trying to understand more about the biology of the cancer so that we can identify what, for example, if these drugs oftentimes cause an initial response, but then the cancer gets smart and bypasses the drug and continues to grow, we'd like to be able to know what causes that to happen so that we can design interventions that will not have that happen. So those are the, so when you see these large-scale trials or even smaller studies like this that are happening, there may be a primary outcome that you're studying, like can we make somebody live longer or can we make their quality of life better? But concurrently, you want to know who's best to be treated in what way. And secondly, you'd like to be able to get clues from your study to make, to design the next one that even creates a more effective treatment or a treatment that has a even a better quality of life.
And Priya, with your permission, that question came from a member of a support group of mine, and I wanted to advocate on his behalf, actually addressing the question he had, which is to pull more men in. Not through clinical trials, but by crowdsourcing, in a way, by having more men share their stories and narratives of what they think works, doesn't work, their experiences, and by having a vast amount of data that can be data mined the way Google mines data. And I'm wondering, to what extent do you think this tool might have an impact? Where might it be a competitor, or might it be a partner with conventional clinical trials?
I think it's absolutely brilliant. And in fact, we've been kicking around the concept of crowdsourcing outcomes of patients, for example, who are on active surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the patients that we manage are, in some respects, they're smarter than their doctors. They do the research in a particular area, and they know exactly what's going on there. Graphics of their PSAs, and they know all of that. You could conceivably crowdsource those kinds of information and provide that to a central repository and develop really innovative observations that would get around some of the concerns that you voiced earlier about biases, selection biases. So it's brilliant. It's definitely going in that direction. There are some issues with regards to consent and issues with regards to how do you, what we call QC the data, make sure that the data are quality data and are not being clogged with. I mean, these days, you know, you can hack into anything, and conceivably you could hack into a crowdsourced medical information clinical trial kind of thing, and it's an issue of making sure that the data are valid, and by the same token, providing privacy to the people who participate. It's complicated.
It is. I understand. Thank you, Doctor.
Priya, would I have a minute to mention a free conference in Chicago?
This is Ian. Do it. Let's take charge. Go.
Thank you. Thank you. Since again, assuming that there are patients listening in, July 26th, which is a Saturday, there's a free prostate cancer conference in Chicago. You can email me. If I'm allowed to give out my phone number, I'll just do that. That would be the easiest thing. 239-208-4400. And the agenda includes William Catalona, Dr. Odo from University of Chicago, and a few other speakers, and myself included. But the focus will be patient empowerment and just helping people to understand their disease better. And it's free.
Great.
Thank you for that, Jen.
Yeah, you're welcome. Did we lose Priya?
Can anybody hear me?
Oh, yeah.
Hi, Mike.
We can.
Hi. Finally. Ian, thank you so much for your time, and I'm so sorry I wasn't here. I was, but nobody could find me.
Well, for the next hour, you can answer the question.
And Jan and Paul, thank you so much for handling, bringing up appropriate questions and things without me here to talk you in or any of that sort of thing. I think a number of really important issues were raised here, and I do think that was a very interesting issue about the way in which we may be able to help to crowdsource more things like this. Just in case you're not aware, there is actually a prostate cancer registry being formed that may help with some of this, but I think it's going to take a considerable time before it becomes a truly valuable tool. Ian, do you have any comments on that registry?
The registry is being developed by the American Urologic Association, and
right.
It is going to track patients, and it's going to provide some of that quality control built into it. So I think so. As a clinical trialist, I'm always a little bit concerned about conclusions that are made from observational studies. Certainly great examples of that are conclusions that are reached from observations with regard to screening studies have been shown to be flawed. Even secondary observations from randomized trials have been proven to be exactly backwards. So it is important. I think one of the important things will be to perhaps improve the quality of outcomes of treatment. But it's an important step.
I don't know if others are experiencing the difficulty on the phone line. If they are causing it, I would urge you to mute if you're not speaking.
I think we are experiencing a lot of audio. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
Yes, I'm so sorry. I apologize so much. I think we're having a lot of background noise. I'm unable to locate the origin, Mike. I'm so sorry that we were not able to bring you on air on time. We've been experiencing a lot of technical issues with this show. I fervently apologize for the same, and thank you everyone for the time. In spite of all the audio disturbances, I think there was a lot of information that was shared. Tom, Paul, and Jan, thank you very much. Dr. Thompson, thank you for being with us today. And I will be sharing the link again with all participants by tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Thank you for extending the offer.
Thank you.